open the House Interim Committee on Rural Communities. Today is December 9th, 2014. Welcome to the committee, everybody. We're going to open an informational meeting. And I'm going to ask Dr. Campbell to come up. And Mark, you going to join him or Scott going to go first? Yeah, okay. Both of you, please come on up. And for those in the audience, several legislators from both chambers, both caucus leaders actually, had the chance to participate in a sort of a summit this summer. And because not everybody could be there, we asked for a sort of a summary and what's next steps out of the summit, because it was fantastic. And I will not say much more about how great it was, because that would be really rude given not everybody was there, but it was just a wonderful chance to get to see an exciting project in Eastern Oregon and hear more about what we can do to help that part of the state. So with that, I would like to welcome Dr. Campbell, who was kind of our host for that summit, along with some other groups that were involved, and tell us all about it.
Thanks, Representative Clem and committee. It's a real honor to be here before you today. I'm Scott Campbell. I own Silly Valley Ranch. Along with my family, I brought my son, Rand, two sons. One's in Lima Law School this year and doing his first year, and Rand's at Oregon State, and following my good friend Mr. Cushing around for this week. So the first thing I want to do is tell you a little bit about the ranch. A lot of you may know a little bit. Back in 2011, the legislature helped us out a lot. We came with an idea to Representative Clem and others that what we wanted to do is use our ranch as a way to try to figure out if there were different strategies that we could use to help recover the economy in rural frontier Oregon. And the idea was to give us the ability to kind of cut through a lot of the red tape and try some different ranching techniques, some ecological restoration techniques, and also to see if there was a way to develop destination tourism, in that part of the state. It's a very, economically depressed part of the state, as we all know. And I'm a veterinarian. I grew up in Burns and was, had a successful veterinary practice headquartered in Portland, and had recently sold that and wanted to figure out how to help things, back home. And so what we did, after we got the bill passed and gave us permission to kind of do some of that stuff, we started doing a lot of restorations of badly eroded streams that had been eroding for about 180 years. And, restoring the ranch and the meadows and the riparian areas to develop better wildlife habitat, recovered fish populations, did a lot of those things, and found that it also helped the productivity of the ranch. Not only did we fix the ecology and the wildlife habitat and have a lot more diversity, but we also increased the economics of the ranch. And then we tried a lot of other things, wind fences, pumped water instead of water out of the creeks, and those kinds of things too, that we found also helped dramatically. And then we started developing a golf course, which is still, everybody got to see last year when they were there. It'll get open this year. And our hope is that we'll be able to attract, just like Mandan did, people from other parts of the United States and the world to bring money into that part of the state. As you guys all know, right now a lot of money comes from Western Oregon that gets paid in taxes over here, goes over there to support basic services in that part of the state. So the idea of the meeting that we had this summer was to bring decision makers and thought leaders to the ranch to see where we were in the progress. It's certainly not done yet, but we've found a lot of things. We work closely with Oregon State and some other schools. We had a PhD student there from Duke for the summer doing economic studies, and so we wanted to get together with some other key thought leaders, Sustainable Oregon, Business Oregon, Oregon Natural Desert Association, which, you know, usually you don't see those guys on cattle ranches, but we've worked closely with them for 4 or 5 years, Tonkin Torp, and our idea was to get 20, 25 people together to kind of see what the progress had been and kind of decide on some next steps. So we work closely with a lot of the legislative leaders, such as Representative Clem, Representative Bentz, the governor, and local community leaders, and we ended up with about 120 people there, which really, really taxed our abilities, but we had a great time and some great tours and a lot of really, really good discussions. And we also had the tribes, manufacturers, a lot of landowners there. The governor came for a couple of days, as did Richard Whitman, so that we could really get kind of everything out in the open. We gave a real hands-on look at the ranch. We spent, 6 hours or something touring, and then dove into a day and a half dialogue about how to get jobs growing, you know, in that part of the state. And, you know, the real bottom line is that, you know, there are some timber jobs and there will be some timber jobs, you know, in the future. But with technology that we have today, even if all those were virgin forests, there wouldn't be very many jobs. And you know, the biggest, by far the biggest industry that we have in Frontier Oregon is livestock. Growing livestock, growing hay for the livestock, but it's clearly the livestock. And so with the kinds of improvements that we've copied from other places in the world, but shown that they can work in our state and the part of it that's depressed, we've shown that we can increase productivity by at least 15%. It's about a $1 billion industry in that part of the state right now. That, you know, 15% sounds an awful lot like, you know, I went to Oregon State, so I can do this math, you know, $150 million. And, you know, increasing the revenues in that part of the state while at the same time, you know, improving the environment is, you know, kind of an Oregon idea. But it's going to take, you know, some things that we talked about at the conference. We have a heavy focus on water and livestock. Tourism is also a big idea, but it's going to take a lot longer to develop. And we're doing it in a unique way there because we're enhancing the environment. It's an eco resort, a very small, and didn't use any agricultural land at all, you know, where we place it. So there's a lot of infrastructure issues to deal with, and there's a lot of educational issues to deal with, which is why Oregon State is such an important piece of doing this. Once you develop the technology or prove the technology will work there, how do you refine that, and how do you get that out to all the other ranches and so forth that are scattered, you know, throughout a state and throughout the part of the state that doesn't even really have, you know, good internet connection or even telephones in many places. So that's kind of what we did. I've asked Mark to kind of who helps me with a lot of policy things and so forth, to kind of summarize some of the takeaways that we had with the legislative folks that were there and the administrating people and the things that we've done since.
So Mark can... Thanks, Scott. Excuse me. Good morning. I'm sorry. My name is Mark Cushing. I'm a partner at Tonkin Torp in Portland. We've had the good fortune to work with Scott in all of his various businesses. And what we did at the summit, which I want to summarize briefly, was address not an issue at the ranch. The ranch had been the beneficiary of the legislation in 2011, and a number of you were involved in that. But the idea of the ranch was to be a model, if you will, a pilot, to try to demonstrate in the far 13 remote counties of eastern Oregon. And we're not talking about Deschutes County or Jefferson County. This isn't central Oregon. This is very much eastern Oregon. As I know Representative Bentz likes to say, when you get to Bend, you have four more hours to go to get to this part of the state. And most people in the Tri-County don't know this part of the state, other than maybe driving out 84 to Pendleton, LeGrand, and out Baker City that way. And the ranch is in Burns and Grant County, and it's a very much a low-density, older population, much higher unemployment than the rest of the state, and inability to recruit the types of jobs that a Washington County, a Clackamas County, a Multnomah County, a Lane County, a Linn County, a Marion, a Benton County can attract. You just don't have the amenities, you don't have the infrastructure, you don't have the resources, and ultimately you don't have the people. And the bigger challenge is that students in high school that graduate from these towns don't have the jobs to stay. So it's not in a state of perpetual decline, but it's at risk of that. And I think that that's not too strong of a term to use. So what we wanted to focus on was realistic economic strategies for that part of the state. And what came out of the summit, and it was a very interesting dialogue, and we appreciated the governor and Richard Whitman and that team and President Ray from Oregon State, and a lot of his senior leadership attended, and a number of members did from the House and Senate, was to focus on three or four initiatives that would be legislative initiatives, if you will, frankly, scaled appropriately, so not that expensive by current standards, that could have a high impact. And they're in the areas of tourism, and this is a part of the state that people visit, but it doesn't have the infrastructure like Central Oregon. It doesn't need to have the scale of Sun River or Black Butte, but it can do much more than it currently does. The natural wonders there, if you will, and the amenities are extraordinary, but you've got to get there, and you've got to have enough hospitality, if you will, while you're there, to want to stay, spend money, and not just be there for a day in a camper, but spend significant time. Obviously, beef livestock, we talked about. Everything's focused on water in that part of the state. You all know this, but if you're not there a lot, you can't appreciate how dry that part of Oregon is and how the issues of eroded streams dominate every ranch and affect how much meadow you have and how much hay production and ultimately how much livestock you can sustain. So those are serious issues, and the state could lend a hand there. And then another concept that's probably central, and you all passed a bill in the 2013 session that was a pilot bill, you may recall, with building codes. And you gave the state building codes flexibility to offer an approach in rural areas of Oregon where, frankly, the city of Portland uniform building code that came from back east, nothing wrong with back east, but the point is it didn't have a whole lot to do with Harney County. Nothing looks like Harney County in New York City or Portland. The risk of all sorts of issues don't apply, but the costs are even greater to try to create the infrastructure that a urban building code might require. And I compliment the legislature. I wasn't heavily involved in that, but I compliment you on a solution that said, why not give the state building code some flexibility, be a one-stop location, focus on outcomes, not on sort of prescriptions that fit an urban environment. And I think you're already seeing, and I'm sure you'll hear this next session, about how that one bill began to provide some certainty and some flexibility. It's a real key issue in the frontier Oregon, those 13 counties, the agencies that folks like Scott and Sandy, his wife, and ranchers encounter are mainly the natural resource agencies, as you'd expect, DSL, Fish and Wildlife, and so forth, the water agencies. And quite frankly, one of the legislative outcomes that's needed, and you can just take the building code legislation as a perfect model, if anything's perfect, but it's as close to perfect as you'll get, I think, is giving those agencies flexibility, giving those agencies encouragement to have outcomes assessment approaches so that you don't come into ranches with prescriptions that just don't fit that life and that world. That they, it may be appropriate on the Willamette River in urban Salem, but it's just not the the scenario that ranches face. And so you end up creating right now disincentives to invest. And Scott was able, with the success of his businesses, to invest significant sums in a level of water restoration that if you haven't been there, and I know Representative Clem has, if you haven't been there, you wouldn't believe it. But when you're there, and I think if you talk to the governor and his team and the other members of both parties that went, they saw a scale of restoration that was hard to imagine. And the beauty of it is, with the work done, meadow gets restored. Meadow becomes habitat for wildlife. Meadow's habitat for beef cattle, right, and productivity. And within 2 to 3 to 4 years, you can pay back your investment. So there's lots of opportunity here. But I think convincing ranchers that you can do it in a way that will be easy to work with agencies and perhaps have some kind of a loan fund that could be paid back in short term would make sense. So the ideas are these. I'll be brief. The ones that center around Oregon State want to take advantage of the land grant nature of Oregon State and the resources it has statewide in all 36 counties, including all 13 of the frontier Oregon counties. So one is to try to create maybe as few as 2 full-time tourism or hospitality extension agents that might come out of the OSU Cascades program, as you know, in Bend now. That program is going to have Oregon State's hospitality program. So you've got the ability to have extension agents that could be stationed not in Bend or Redmond or sisters, but could go out to frontier Oregon counties and teach people in the tourist industry and provide resources. And John Day and Burns and Baker City and LeGrand, it's not limited to obviously Sylvie's area, but you need to sort of teach people and train them how to create the hospitality environment that you need to attract not just folks from Portland or people from Bend, but people from San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago and New York and Washington and from Beijing and from Tokyo that might want to come and have this wildlife and golf and eco-resort experience. But you can't just plop them down right now in John Day and assume that it's all going to work right and they're going to come back and it's going to be sustained. And even this ranch was originally a guest ranch to support the German tourist industry, believe it or not. It was going to be a dude ranch for Germans, and that lasted one time when they flew a group of Germans over and they had them ride horses for 15 hours a day, you know, and eat dust and said, how's it going so far? Is this a pretty great experience? And I think the return rate was fairly low, as in that project ended. So you have to do special things. So we could see the need for just a couple of extension agents in the hospitality sector coming out of Oregon State, located there. I think you could take up to 5 to 10 more, but the group in the discussion at the Frontier Summit felt that you could take up to 5 to 10 more extension agents focused on beef cattle, because the ranches are spread out, and right now the number of ranches and the number of head of cattle, if you will, that a given extension agent has to cover to try to really train better economic techniques, better water restoration techniques, marketing techniques, and so forth. Not a large investment, but would have a high impact. I think in the area of water and water research, we're trying to demonstrate to folks that the particular technique Scott's used, which the phrase he's come up with is artificial beaver dams, that recreates what the beaver did in this valley 180 years ago. And 200,000 beavers were taken out of this valley, just Sylvie's Valley alone, about 20 miles by 10 miles. They were taken by the Hudson Bay Company. 200,000 beavers were taken out. Very profitable at the time, and it's the reason why the streams are cut down and abused, and the water just runs, and it's gone, and it's not able to create the meadow and the environment you need to sustain cattle. Well, Scott's got the techniques that he's tested with his investments, with no state assistance, to prove how a certain technique can have dramatic, literally within 3 months, impact, both for wildlife and for cattle. So But you need research to document it. Oregon State has the resources and the expertise to do it. Probably a couple of positions there to really teach and then show ranchers how to do it at a scale that they can handle would make sense. The next issue, which I know Representative Klim has an interest in, is the idea that there's a unique quality to agriculture in Oregon, not just limited to eastern Oregon, and we would support what we call Certified Oregon, that you would create a brand that would just be called the Certified Oregon brand, and it would embody a whole host of sustainable practices and best practices that the ranch and others could take advantage of and actually would probably be a great marketing tool for the state. I think it's worth investing some money there. Probably experiment with it at first, but it wouldn't have to be limited to food products. But if you just did that in the food product world, as you all know, with Portlandia and with all the new sort of culinary value that Oregon's associated with, well, the production side of the state could take advantage of that, but you need some horsepower behind it, and I think Oregon State could probably drive that. So it adds up to maybe a $2 to $3 million scale of investment, mainly in people, mainly through extension agent type people that could drive those programs, get the message out, teach and do the things that you need to do in that part of the state. You're not going to drive from John Day to Corvallis to learn how to do something on your ranch. You know, it's got to be done out there. It's got to be done on a scale that's appropriate. So that's the type of approach that we think Representative Klim and the committee is feasible. I think you'd find bipartisan support for it, and I think you can take an institution with the infrastructure of Oregon State and get a lot of that done, which would have the double benefit that the OSU would get more and more reputation for being able to deliver those kind of services. So I'm not sure if I left anything out. I know there's a project that our partner Sustainable Northwest is working on in Juniper, and there's some forest type recovery projects scaled, not of the sort that we were used to before, but would make sense. That could be a model for what we're talking about.
And Scott, was I going to wrap up, or just be you guys are here for questions at this point? Right again. Any questions for these two?
I guess I have one. Maybe two. Thank you, Chair Klim. This is a fascinating project, and I've had the great privilege of spending a lot of time over in your neck of the woods and enjoy it every time my husband and I get over there. It's usually in the fall. But could Biz Oregon play a role in this Certified Oregon piece? And you mentioned Oregon State, but it seems to me that the branding issue may have a home at Biz Oregon. I don't know if that was part of the conversation or not.
We're still in conversation about that.
Okay.
That and what exactly you want to tackle in the initial stage. Do you go beyond food into other categories or not? Which is part of the discussion about where it's housed.
Okay.
If you're sticking with food, you've got the Food Innovation Center.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
But if you're going to go outside of that, then you need probably different...
Something bigger.
Yeah, that can handle other industry categories.
Okay, good.
The discussion, some of the discussion that we had was about, you have to make it really stand for something. So there has to be some sort of certification for the producers. And so if it's agricultural producers, clearly, Oregon State would, some of the county agents, could be the people who do a lot of the certification. But clearly, if you're going to certify tennis shoes as being sustainable, that's probably not the right spot.
Yeah, and maybe there's two ways to go at that, whether it's food or something that's, non-perishable.
But it would really leverage the dollars that we spend, outside the state. It would leverage those dollars across the whole and all the industries in Oregon instead of just tourism.
Sure, got it. I also happen to know on the southern coast of Oregon, where there is a very robust population of beavers that may be happily relocated to another part of the state, where there is an overabundance who are creating a serious problem. So if you need to reestablish a beaver population, you might want to give me a call.
if you tried to do that, you'd probably experience the joys of permitting. I would try to figure out how to get those young beavers.
I'm sure.
If we could get them there, they'd find some habitat they like.
I just happen to know where there are a lot of them.
All right.
What we've found is you have to have the habitat.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's a chicken and egg thing, but clearly you have to have the habitat before you can get the beavers. And once you get the habitat, the beavers show up pretty readily. We have a lot of beaver dams on top of artificial beaver dams, you know, because we restored the habitat. There have been some pretty good studies that show if you take beavers where there are too many and put them where there's not habitat yet, they get eaten by other wildlife.
Sure.
Unfortunately.
Thank you.
You bet. Other questions? So these items that were just described that are, you know, mostly funding related will end up being a bill, but the timeline in September to have that in, we didn't put anything in, so it'll be one of the non-pre-session filed bills. There's some elements of the package already in the governor's budget that are essentially pops in the Ways and Means process that are available to support, but we will have some bills if you're interested in signing on the bills. We'll have some bills at some point. Representative Holvey.
Thank you. Curious. I'm just trying to, you know, get a scope of what's being asked of the state to provide. Is it training to how to ranch ecologically without harming the environment, and also how to run a hospitality business?
You guys can take a stab, but I think the first thing is these restoration efforts require technical knowledge on how to do them. And, you know, they're not that expensive to do, but it's important you do them correctly. And it took some work to figure out how to get them right. And particularly for natural resource agencies, it's important you know how to work with them when you're doing them, too, because you're, in some cases, modifying things that, you know, under the jurisdiction of the state. So the goal on the restoration side of a, say, a stream that runs dry every year after a few months, but you want to have it have water year-round and use a beaver dam to slow it down, that's the kind of thing they would help instruct the cattle ranchers on how to do, if I got that right.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal is, besides repairing the environment to what it was when beavers were still there, is you also end up with flood irrigation that creates more forage, which helps you pay back the investment in these ecological restorations, because you're going to make more money off of your hay or having a place for your cattle to go at the same time. So you end up not having to just get grants from the state to do it. You could do a loan that actually, or if they've got enough resources, they can do it without even, with just the technical know-how, they could do it without even money from the state. Just advice on how to make sure you're doing it correctly. Representative McEwen.
Just one other comment. In the last session, we had conversations about the juniper issue in the areas where junipers become an invasive species, and certifying juniper for certain uses so we can incentivize people to move that off what was historically rangeland. And I see on your website that that's something that is on your radar also. I just wanted to know if you were aware that we're working very hard to deal with that issue legislatively, and would love to have your thoughts if there's anything else that we should be doing in that area. It's been recognized as a significant problem.
Well, you know, juniper's been a growing, literally growing problem. And there's been a lot written on it, and there's a lot of experts that are a lot brighter than me on juniper. We have a few thousand acres of juniper, and just going and cutting the juniper isn't the answer. You know, it's a piece of the answer. The reality is that an awful lot of the juniper that needs to be cut, thank God, is not marketable size yet. and another reality is that as soon as you cut the marketable stuff, 2 years later, or not 2 years, but 3 or 4 years later, there's three times more juniper, and it's high enough that we couldn't see each other. And the other thing is, if you just go in and you cut a mature juniper forest, there's frequently not enough brush and grass underneath, and so you actually create a lot of environmental damage because there's nothing there to stop erosion. And so it's another Oregon State issue where people need education about how to do it. You need to look at the whole watershed. And if you don't fix the streams that may not be running water at all because there's so much juniper there, and you take out the juniper, and then all the rain doesn't or the snow doesn't evaporate before it hits the ground like it does in a mature stand of juniper, and that's all hitting the ground and running off, you're going to cause tremendous erosion for miles, or you can. And so you really need, just cutting juniper isn't any kind of a solution. You need to really look at all the ecology because there are great benefits to society for fixing that problem. There aren't today, big snowpacks that last partway through the summer. Where there were as recently as, 20, 30 years ago. And so we don't have that water coming down, the watersheds now later in the year for the fish, but also just to drink, And so you've really got to think about it broadly, and when we do a stream restoration, when we first started doing stream restorations, we just did stream restoration. Now we do watershed restorations, and we thin the juniper. We also thin the pine trees, because the pine trees in the wrong place, juniper are fine if they're in the right spot. It's just that they've grown now into places that are no longer the right spots, and pine trees are the same way. They also grow in a lot of places they shouldn't grow. And if you want to come over to the ranch, I can show you. A lot of those streams that were once beaver streams and are now just dry gullies once were meadows. And when we put artificial beaver dams back in them, we get meadows back right away. Mm-hmm. And it actually drowns the pine trees that are there. Because they're not supposed to be down in meadows either. And if you look at the age of most of those pine trees that are down in those meadows, they're all about 150 years old or younger. They started after the beavers were removed. The great thing is they're pretty marketable, and so you can kind of remove the weed, and the weed pays for the restoration. But the Oregon Department of Forestry doesn't want you to remove the trees next to the streams until they start drowning, there are a lot of the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. And certainly taking care of the juniper is part of the solution. The other thing that we've been doing, to try to figure out the juniper problem more long term is once you fix the stream so that you're not going to have erosion, and then you remove the juniper, and you don't have to remove them all at once. You could remove a third of them at a time. Mm-hmm. And then eventually put fire back in there. The problem is you get all these little ones that grow, and so we're developing a breed of goat with the help of Oregon State from seed stock in the U.S. and South Africa that actually eat the baby junipers.
Cool.
Then we're selling them as goat meat. 70% of the red meat eaten in the world is goat. And so there's a huge, huge market for high-quality goat meat. And almost every ranch, in Oregon, could have a second crop, literally, by growing goats, because they won't eat grass. We put our cattle in a pasture. They eat all the grass. Then we put the goats in. And they get fat in there, where the cattle have already eaten the grass. And so, it's another way, but it's going to take a lot of education because there's a lot of things that aren't known really yet about how to raise meat goats in the high desert and then developing the markets and all the rest of that.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Campbell got a call last year sometime from the governor asking about gorst and goats.
Gorst?
Maybe you should tell Dr. Campbell your connection to gorst.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm married to a wonderful man, and his great-great-grandfather's name was George Bennett, and he hailed from Bandon, Ireland, and he came to this country in the 1860s and landed on the south coast of Oregon, and he was a sheep rancher and came to southern Oregon with gorse. In Ireland, they used it as hedgerows, and we have the disreputable claim to fame of bringing gorse to the south coast of Oregon.
Yeah. Bring the Scotch broom, too?
Not the Scotch broom. We do take no credit for the Scotch broom. Only the gorse. Gorse.
Well, Dr. Kitzhaber.
And golfers, particularly. but it is a problem, and we would love to find a goat that could eat gorse.
Yeah, well, they will, and they control it, actually, in Scotland. And so... Dr. Kitzhaber got me together with the folks at Bandon, and we've got them in contact with, you know, how to get some goats, and
they'll be very welcome. So. I'm sure Mr. Kaiser will be very happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions at this point?
Good. Great project. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank
Thanks for much. Coming down. I don't have to open or anything. Okay, so we're going to move on to our next item, which is another one of my favorite projects. The first half of the meeting is my favorite projects. So can we ask Representative Barton to join us? We're bringing the other folks now. Do you want to go first and then, or bring the folks with you?
As you wish, Mr. Chair. Actually, I will be very brief.
Okay, so why don't we get Catherine and Jim and Tony on your way up here, too.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 40. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time to learn more about a great project, and a project that I have been talking about for a while and will continue to talk to each and every one of you about in the coming year. It is, many people don't realize that right in the middle of Oregon City is, in fact, the second largest waterfall in the United States by volume, second only to Niagara Falls. It is kind of a cradle of Oregon, and always has been. It has been a place where Native Americans have gathered to fish and to trade for millennia. And it was the site of Dr. John McLaughlin's homestead. It's when he moved from Fort Vancouver and homesteaded there because of these falls, where he set up his water wheel. And this site, these falls, have been in continuous industrial use since McLaughlin's water wheel, and not available to the public. The only place really the public can see it are kind of two very poor lookouts, one from I-205 and one from 99 East. Now, we have an opportunity, starting about 2 years ago when the Blue Heron paper mill closed, to redevelop this site. This opportunity is a better than a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Oregon, and certainly for Oregon City, probably the best opportunity facing Oregon City since the Oregon Trail. It has been... It's really something. It's going to expand Main Street, Oregon City, probably by 50%. It's going to revolutionize tourist traffic to Oregon City, particularly in the winter when the falls are just booming. It's something else. So I am going to play about a 90-second video, and then I'm going to turn it over to the panel. And I want you to note that I'm joined today by experts on this project who have been working on it from the city of Oregon City, Clackamas County, as well as Metro. There are also people from the federal government as well as the state of Oregon have been working on it. This is that kind of project. It breaks barriers. Everyone has been getting behind this, Republican, Democrat, whatever jurisdiction they may be. This is a rally around the flag issue, certainly for my community, but really, I think, for the state of Oregon. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to play the video, if I may.
Walk down Main Street in Oregon City, and you'll hit a dead end at a complex of hollow industrial buildings. No people, no cars, not even the hum of a machine. Oregon began here. Behind this shell, North America's second most powerful waterfall roars through the Willamette River, carrying salmon and lamprey for longer than any of us can remember. This has been a sacred place for Native Americans. Generations of workers made flour and wool and paper on this land. But as industry grew, we lost our connection with the force that created it. For more than a century, Willamette Falls has been the most spectacular place we don't visit. That's about to change. When the final paper mill closed in 2011, thousands of Oregonians came together to shape the future of Willamette Falls. They imagined a project that would do justice to the beauty of this place, that would honor the past and speak to the future. With your help, this vision is becoming a reality. Get ready to rediscover the falls.
You can see why I'm so excited about this, why we're so excited about this. And thank you for your time, Mr. Chair. Can I pass it on to
you? You bet, absolutely.
Good morning.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Jim Desmond, and I'm the director of the Sustainability Center at Metro, and we've been one of the four public partners in this project, and I'll introduce this. From the beginning, very shortly after the bankruptcy was declared and the plant closed, the local governments came together and agreed from very early on in the project that there were four values that should drive this project, and those hold true to this day, and those four values are to provide public access to the falls, to create an opportunity for economic redevelopment, to create healthy habitat in what is nearly a half mile of river frontage frankly a gem that's waiting to be polished. And the fourth is the cultural and historic interpretation of the site. There's obviously a rich Native American history as well as a rich industrial and post-industrial future for the site. We've made substantial progress since the last legislative session. The legislature appropriated a $5 million bond issuance through state parks. Those bonds are scheduled to be sold in January of 2015. And the idea there was that appropriation would jumpstart the project. And we want to thank the legislature for that. And we're here to report that that strategy worked. That was what was at that time somewhat of still a concept and a dream, if you will, has now become an actual live project, and we've leveraged that money significantly since then. The specific progress is the bankruptcy has been resolved and the property's been purchased by a private investor who has indicated this week to the governor's office that their intent is to bring private investment of $400 to $600 million to the project over the next 20 to 30 years. We've done significant public outreach around the project and engaged over 3,000 citizens. There's a friends group that's formed, and there's been a nearly unanimous consensus in the community to support those four values and create both a public river walk along the river, but also a robust economic redevelopment in the back of the site. There's a master plan that's been approved, and Tony Conkle from the city will talk about the rezoning of the site. And Catherine Comer from the county will talk about the potential for jobs and tourism and some other things that the county's been taking the lead on, including federal lobbying that we're optimistic about the future of federal funding here as well. The leverage that I mentioned, we have a little over $7 million in hand or has been spent so far on the project in addition to the state's five, and that's cash money. The in-kind from the four partners will be greater, and we feel the potential for very significant funding on top of that is there. And our next step is that Metro is about to issue a request for proposal for the initial design and engineering of the walkway so that we would begin to have a schematic design and take that into initial engineering so that we could build the walkway. And we have secured an easement from Portland General Electric that walkway that they showed that transformed, that moved from left to right, and you could see people walking out along a walkway into the river. That's actually owned by Portland General Electric, and they've granted a public easement in favor of the public partners for the purpose of bringing the public there. And we have a term letter that's been signed by the landowner to provide a public access easement across the river, and the attorneys are wrapping up final documents there, dotting I's, crossing T's, but we do have a term letter, and the landowner has donated that easement to the public. And has also agreed to put cash into the project moving forward in addition to his land donation, so is now an active partner. We're thrilled with that progress, and a great deal of that is due to the state's faith in the project. I want to thank you again for your appropriation and introduce you to Tony Conkle from the City of Oregon City.
Good morning, Chair Clem and representatives. My name is Tony Conkle. I'm the Community Development Director with Oregon City. I, along with Jim and Catherine, we've been involved with this project pretty much since the beginning. In February of 2011, Blue Heron closed, and we lost 175 well-paying jobs that have been in our community for over 100 years. We set out at that point, and we kind of started to try to get an understanding of the property. Since the bankruptcy and through the recent adoption of the land use document by my city commission, the partners have put together and spent $1.6 million in trying to get an understanding of the project, an expansive public engagement process where really the first question was, we do this right. In 25 years, you walk on this property. What do you see? What don't you see? We engaged a much larger group than just Oregon City. We came into all throughout the metro region. We believe that the catalytic value of this property and the spinoff from this can be pretty significant, and Catherine will talk about that in a little after I conclude here. We would actually go to parts of the community, and no one would actually believe that there was a 43-foot waterfall on the Willamette River in downtown Oregon City. So the education process, the excitement around that, culminated with the adoption of a master plan. It was a framework master plan that identified where buildings should be located, general uses on the property. We negotiated with the Oregon Department of Transportation on improvements to 99E and access to the site. We adopted a multimodal mixed-use area designation for 99E in order to successfully make a comprehensive plan amendment and a zone change from industrial to a new zone entitled the Willamette Falls Downtown District. And throughout that whole process, Jim talked about the four values. And those four values have been the guiding principle. And each of the partners have adopted those four values by their electeds. And we've used those as the check-in as we've gone through this process. We also had a partners group, which was made up of two elected officials and the CEO from each of the partners, Clackamas County, Metro, Oregon City, and the state. Representative Barton and Senator Olson served on that, and we thank them for their efforts on that. So we went to them every 6 to 8 weeks to update on the process, have guidance and feedback on where we should be heading. So throughout this process, it's been very, very successful. We've been able to put together funds to move forward. We have support from the elected officials at each of those agencies. The land use addressed providing certainty so that we can have private investment back in the process, but with enough flexibility that we don't know what's going to happen in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years and what the market's going to demand. And so it provides that certainty to the market as well as the elected officials and the citizens to know where we're heading with enough flexibility that we can address what the market is calling for as we move forward. In front of you, you have what we call the vision strategy document. What this does is it encapsulates all the great ideas and thoughts and desires and wants that we heard through the public engagement process that you really couldn't codify. So this document is incorporated into how we will move forward on the property. These are aspirations that are meant to be met as we develop the property, but like I said, couldn't really be codified. It'll be a reference document as we move forward. In there, you'll see towards the end the actual framework master plan that was adopted. You saw a picture of it up on the screen, as well as some demonstration plans. There's four of them in there that try to show the flexibility that can happen on this site, where development can occur, where public access can occur. And so really the main point is that in each one of those demonstration plans, it shows from what would be a little less intensive development with more open space or public access to more intensive development. But in all of those, you're showing open space, you're showing the public access along the river and out to the falls, and how that can be accomplished. These are not how it's going to happen. These are setting the sideboards on what the opportunities are. So with that, I'll go ahead and conclude and turn it over to Catherine Crohn.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Again, my name is Catherine Comer. I'm Manager of Business and Economic Development for Clackamas County. Very excited and grateful to be here this morning. As Jim and Tony said, this has been a long road for 2 years, exciting focus on this legacy project in this site. And if any of you have not been to the site, I would like to personally invite you to come and take a tour with us. It is impossible to stand next to these these falls and not see the beauty, feel the history, and look around and see the opportunity that this site has for the region and the state. And as Tony said and Jim reiterated, a great opportunity for revitalization of downtown Oregon City. Clackamas County has been involved with this project since the beginning when Blue Heron closed and, as Jim said, lost 175 jobs. Our economic consultants are telling us that there is an opportunity to create up to 1,000 living wage jobs on this site. And Clackamas County has certainly been focused on economic redevelopment of this area and the revitalization of downtown Oregon City. Clackamas County Board of Commissioners adopted a strategic plan in August of 2014 in which they prioritized growing a vibrant economy. We see the Willamette Falls Legacy Project as a key piece to growing a vibrant economy, both for tourism development. Clackamas County Tourism and Cultural Affairs, who have been supportive since the beginning, just recently granted a tourism development grant for this area. They see it as a game changer for tourism development in Clackamas County. The Board of County Commissioners have also invested $100,000 towards the framework master plan for this site, which was just completed, and then another $100,000 towards the efforts to identify and secure additional sources of public funding for this project. Again, we see this as an incredible opportunity both for Oregon City, Clackamas County, Metro, the state, and the region, and appreciate your support. And again, please come and visit if you haven't. It's an incredible site and an incredible opportunity. Thank you.
Chair, can we answer any questions?
Yeah, please. Any questions from the committee?
It's a great project.
Are you my vice chair or not? Representative Davis.
Floating here. Thanks to you. Thank you, Chair. And thank you very much for spending the time to come down here and talk about the project. It's very exciting. As a graduate of Westland High School, I can tell you for years, literally, I drove by on Willamette Falls Drive without an awareness for the tremendous natural asset that the falls are. Where are things at with the owner? Because currently the actual owner of the site isn't on the panel. This is all the government agencies. So where are discussions at with the owner? We're talking about, it sounds like, is it some essentially permanent easements over part of it for public use or transfer of part of the site for public use? Talk about where that's at. Public-private partnership.
Yes, Chair Clem, Representative Davis, to your question, it's Jim Desmond. Metro's been taking the lead on the real estate negotiations. We've negotiated the terms of an easement with the private landowner, so it would be a permanent easement along the riverfront. That easement is in the process of getting, we sent them signature documents based on a letter of intent that the two parties had signed about 2 weeks ago. And he has endorsed the plan you have in front of you was specifically endorsed by the landowner. He filed the land use application to the city to have the site rezoned for the mixed use, has been a very active participant, and as part of the terms of that easement, which is in the process of getting signed, he will be a financial partner and responsible for costs going forward, and the easement's being donated to the public. So we feel he's been extremely cooperative. He's an investor out of the state of Washington, although he grew up in Hillsborough, and very much on the page. In fact, he has stated publicly that if it were not for the public partnership and the involvement of the three agencies here, and State Parks has been a tremendous assistant partner in this as well. We've had a tremendous amount of expertise from State Park staff. He says that but for that partnership, the robust and effective manner that the public partners, he would not have purchased the property. That was a big driver for him. So we feel we have a partner. That said, this is a complex project. This is not, you know, this is not a cookie cutter. It's not like anything else. It's buildings have been built at various stages since the 1840s. So it's a complex site, and it'll take some time. But he's been extremely cooperative.
Mr. Heigerkin, sorry, Representative Davis. Mr. Heigerkin purchased the property in May of 2014. we were in the process. As part of our partnership, we also had the bankruptcy trustee, which was just another example of the strong partnership we were put together. The bankruptcy trustee actually put money into the planning process to help us get to where we're at. And so we didn't have a property owner to negotiate with. We were using the bankruptcy trustee. When Mr. Heigerkin bought the property in May, we were about to submit, and the trustee was about to sign the land use app. We stopped everything for about 2.5 months and brought Mr. Heigerkin and his team up to speed on the work we've been doing for the previous 3 years. We had negotiations with him, discussions with him, and in the end, he not only joined the partnership in our 6 to 8 week meetings that we had with leadership, he also adopted those four values as his four values and did sign, as Jim said, the land use application and was the actual one submitting that.
And one final point, Representative Davis, is that don't think of this as that there'll be a sidewalk and then there'll be a big development behind it. This will be an integrated project where, and we're talking about probably, Mr. Heidgerken has said it should be at least a 30-foot wide. He uses the term promenade. And then along the way, you'd have plazas and and lookouts. And so it would really be seamless with his development. Mm-hmm. And both our private consultants and Mr. Heidgerken, everybody, all real estate people have looked at the site, feel that that public access is really the catalyst to the rest of the site, that but for the falls and this opportunity to bring the public there, the property would have a very different future. So the two need to be integrated. And he views it that way as well. And he works with our team on all these issues.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
And maybe I missed it. What's the timeline on public access at this point?
At this point, we've just concluded the PGE negotiations. We're still in the process of concluding the negotiations with Mr. Heidgerken and getting that signed. We will begin. We're sending out this request for proposal to begin design and engineering. We think that will be about an 18-month process. The permitting here will be extensive, and we will also need the permission of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC as they're known. I'm looking back to Michelle, see if I got the acronym right there. If we go out over the dam, which we intend to, that will require permission from FERC. So there's a pretty lengthy permit process. So, but we hope to begin, we hope to have some design and engineering within 2 years and then begin a design and go into construction and perhaps have some interim access along the way where we can begin to get the public out there sooner than that. But it's full steam ahead. We're gonna move this as quickly as possible. Just frankly, it's just subject to permitting. We have the financing in hand to begin the first phase. We have about $11 million identified to begin, which would be enough to get the public out there. With maybe not the final treatment, but significant project.
And what's the allocation of the $5 million the legislature is bonding?
The
state's bonding.
Yeah, the state is responsible for $5 million
of that 11.
Okay. And the remainder is coming from the local partners, primarily Metro, through a natural areas bond measure that our voters passed in 2006. The presence of the second largest waterfall in North America makes this a high priority for us from a natural resource point of view, and so we're committing funds from that bond measure. We also think, I don't want to overpromise, so we're just using that number. We are very confident that when we get the design and engineering, this will attract grant money. There are a number of grant programs. We're meeting with the local philanthropic community. We've had tours out there with Meyer Memorial, Oregon Community Foundation, Bullet. We feel that the potential to bring in other partners, and particularly the federal government, as we have real engineering and hard cost to show people, we're very confident. We're aggressive in trying to seek other funding.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Clem. Are there brownfield issues on this site, the area that you're developing?
Chair Clem, Representative McCown, to your question. The interesting thing about the site is that when you say brownfield, you're normally talking about either groundwater contamination or soil contamination. The river portion of the site, when you get down the bottom, is nearly all basalt rock. Then you have these, to oversimplify it, you think about large columns that would come up and then hold a cement platform where Main Street was, and you know, when they walk down Main Street, it's all cement. If you go out there today, there's barely a blade of grass until you really get out. So the normal brownfield issues of ongoing contamination are not present. We spent about roughly $300,000 on extensive environmental tests have been shared with DEQ, and they have agreed that the site is completely appropriate for redevelopment. The challenge is in the buildings that are there. There are old boilers, there's asbestos, so there's some inside the building kind of stuff that will be expensive and complex, but eminently doable, and not with the sort of legal restrictions that a Superfund or brownfield designation would bring. So that due diligence work was done early on in the project to make sure that there was not a threshold problem there that we couldn't solve.
Great, thank you. And just for the record, it's McEwen.
McEwen, I apologize.
You get a pass, it's fine.
I thank you, and I apologize. It
happens all the time. Yeah.
Other questions?
I have a question.
Yeah, Representative Boyles.
Any archaeology or historical site issues?
You want to take that?
Sure. Yeah. At our initial investment in due diligence in the property, what we did is we came in, and essentially there's about 600,000 square feet of buildings and structures on what we call the Main Street level. Mm-hmm. We engaged with the State Historic Preservation Office early on to come up with a methodology on how we would start to identify and get an understanding of what the historical resources are on that property. So essentially we went in, we had George Kramer from Kramer Architects. He's done mm-hmm. over 20 years of experience working on both sides of the falls and historic preservation, an architect in KPFF structural. And we went in and we actually broke it down into about 59 separate buildings and identified what the building or structure was, when it was constructed, what it was constructed of. So we had a very good base to understand what the resources were there. Nothing on the property is designated on the local local inventory. We identified four buildings and the old woolen mill foundation mm-hmm. as the buildings that would had the highest reuse potential with the highest historic value. We've also, as part of the RFP that we're about to put out, we are working with putting together the plans for how we would deal with archaeological finds. Mm-hmm. We're working with Confederate tribes of the Grand Ronde and the other Native American tribes to identifying Native American resources or important aspects of the property. And so we will have those plans in place as we start this due diligence work on the scope for the Riverwalk. To not only look for those, but if we find them, how do we handle them?
Sure. Great.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, first of all, thank you for your continued interest in this. Chair Clement and I was actually, I know it seems hard to believe, I'm not a very speedy man, but I was out jogging one day. And I see Chair Clem loitering, trying to look at the falls.
Where are they?
And so each of us, you know, get invited to various legislative tours, et cetera, of varying degrees of interest to each of us. I want to reiterate that. Each and every one of you, I'd love it if you'd come and see the falls. We can hang out afterwards if you want, or if that would condemn the project and you don't want to hang out with me, you can do the tour on your own. But really, these pictures and this video, in our words, don't do it justice. It is something else. It's hard to believe that these falls are here and no one knows about it. And when you get up right close, there's nothing quite like it. It's also one of the rare things in Western Oregon that is probably more fun in the winter than the summer, because those falls are just booming right now. So please, during session, perhaps if you have a free evening, you're most welcome in Oregon City.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, yeah, thanks for coming. I as Representative Barton said, I got lucky because I didn't know they were there either particularly. Of course, I'd heard the term, but I hadn't even stopped. And we were scouting locations for a Chinese film crew who wanted to film interesting things in Oregon. And they'd already been to Portland once and done sort of the Rose Garden, all that kind of stuff. And it was about a month or 5 weeks before they got here. And somewhere on the internet, I saw a picture. I'm like, well, where is that? And then I was out looking at it. I went to 205 side and couldn't really see it close enough. And so then one of my colleagues and I went over to 99 side. And I'm leaning over the thing. And I hear Brian. And I'm so fascinated by the falls, I didn't really notice. Clem! And here's a much more fit than I jogger coming by. And he immediately took the time to break up his both his probably jog and then rest of his day to take me down there and get a look. And then I was able to bring the film crew. So they're actually doing in a province of about 100 million people, they came and filmed, and they're going to continue to monitor the progress of this site for Chinese tourists. who may want to come. And from my perspective, I think the thing that was interesting is you think of Niagara Falls as a national destination, and to think of the spillover effect to the rest of Oregon, if you had something that is thought of like Niagara Falls, of course they're then going to go see the coast and see Crater Lake and go see Sylvie's Valley Ranch and other things. But you've got to have something that commands their attention to come here. That's relatively close to the airport, because I've done a lot of now discussions with international tourists, and when you say Crater Lake, great, until they hear how far it is away from the airport. And this is something where you can get them in here, and then we move them throughout the rest of the state. So I just think it's a thrilling opportunity for the whole state. Otherwise, I probably would not have asked the speaker to let me do it in this committee. You know, like they said, what's the rural? I said, look, this is a statewide significant project. This is not just an Oregon City or even a metro project.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, you kind of touched on one of the things I've been thinking about, is the name of this committee is not accurate, and maybe we should petition the speaker to change it to Oregon Communities instead of Rural Communities, unless Metro is now considered a rural community.
Not a bad idea. Yeah. There are some rural communities
and
in
there's
Metro,
probably some rural development funds we might be able to attract to this, perhaps.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for coming
and
sharing.
Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's
on to another rural issue.
Yep, let's move on to our the land use part of our rural communities jurisdiction.
Of your charge,
MACB.
MACB. Adjustment Bill. So Jim, Randy, and Mary Kyle, do you want to come up? And what we've got here, colleagues, as you remember during the short session, we produced House Bill 4078, initially part of it in this committee and then in rules at the end. And the group in front of you represents a variety of different interests who worked on the bill. And what we found was, in the speed of trying to name things correctly and get section and township and tracks in there, we just plain missed a few things. And so these are not people or streets or others coming for a second bite of the apple to try and get in on the agreement that was reached between a lot of different parties. There may be some of those bills coming. That's not this bill. This bill is literally technical adjustments where we had a map, and then when we wrote the bill, the words didn't end up matching the map. If I've got that right, please walk us through what we're up to here.
Chair Clement, I think I'm done. No, we'll walk through the mapping. So for the record, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. Chair Clement outlined the process on how we got to 4078. What you've got in front of you really are what can be termed as Scribner errors in the drafting process, something that doesn't physically match up with reality on the ground. And there's a series of those adjustments physically in the bill. It's easier to explain it really just from the mapping standpoint. And the first one you've got in front of you is specific to Gordon Road. It was mapped. Essentially, what the mapping should have done is it should have included it as a rural reserve. It wasn't physically noted as such in the language, physically in the legislation that went through the process. So this, again, it's a physical fix to make sure that that road becomes part of the rural reserve that is next to it.
Scroll on down. How about that one?
Yeah, so the oddity is that you're going to see in some of this stuff is, if you miss a north, or if you add a northwest where it doesn't belong, this is kind of what ends up happening in this process. This, again, is a segment on Northwest Purdon Road. The recommendation here is to make sure that blip is part of the rural reserve that surrounds it. There's no point of having anything inside of an intersection be anything other than that. So there's a series of changes that I'll say kind of took place along West Union Road. The first one on this is really a tax lot, and it ultimately was just a different call. It was called out as being something different physically in the legislation, and it didn't match up with, again, how this is physically mapped. So The recommended change in this is to make sure that this tax lot goes from an urban reserve to undesignated. And again, it's a matter of making sure that that lines up with that physical change on the map.
That's down in the lower left
right.
corner.
Looks like Nebraska.
Yeah. Go then up, and is that? Are there two on one there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then there's a undesignated going to rural there too in the upper right. So.
Go ahead, jump in.
The way this is, Randy Tucker with Metro. The way this one's been explained to me is that it's a matter of the designation of the lots with the township section range that was erroneous, and so what got designated in the bill as being undesignated is the large one at the top right when it meant to do the small one at the bottom left.
Gotcha.
And so this is just this is just getting the correct lot designation into the statutes. So as Jim said earlier, a Scrivener's error, or maybe you said, Chair Clem. So that's what that one is.
Okay. Next one.
As I understand it.
All right. Is that West Union? Yeah. So, again, it's a matter of things matching up physically here. The recommendation is to make sure that this section of Northwest Union Road is designated as an urban reserve, which has the adjacency to development to the south along that whole strip. One thing that's important, I think, to point out on this is Chair Clem mentioned all the work that went into 4078. Several different organizations were part of that final solution. We essentially used that same template to develop this type of mapping errors to make sure that we weren't trying to address policy issues, and this truly was a mapping error fix. So we worked with, again, Mary Kyle with 1,000 Friends. It was Department of Ag. It was Friends of Helvetia. It was also Metro, City of Hillsborough, City of Beaverton, as well as Washington County in this whole process as well. So we've done our homework over the summer to essentially bring you something that is, I'll say, essentially a final product in front of you. Ah, yes.
There's more.
There's more, exactly. So this is, again, becomes a tax lot description issue. Again, the entirety of this tax lot should be a physical urban reserve and not be some kind of an island that's stuck there. There's really a couple of pieces on this. One is the physical road itself, Cornelius Pass, and the other is that island that is surrounded. And the recommendation on this is to make sure that both the road is changed to urban reserve, as well as the rural reserve, as it's described in here, moves into an urban reserve setting, which is, again, what surrounds it.
That's it.
And that's it?
Yeah. Yep. Any questions about those? Oh, sorry. Mary Kyle,
Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you, Chair Clem, and members of the committee. We've reviewed these map changes, as Jim and Randy stated. They're really clarification of road names. One of those mistakes you saw was they were both tax lot 100, but they're in different townships. It makes a big difference. clarifying directions, and we've reviewed them, and they're consistent with what the intent was, and there's nothing other than technical changes. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Randy Tucker with Metro, that I'm mainly here to say the same thing, that we've reviewed them, we agree with them, they were what everyone intended to in the first place. I would just maybe, Jim talked about 4078 being the final solution. I might use a different term with a less egregious historical echo. But, and it probably isn't the final solution anyway. So, but at any rate, we're fully in support of these changes, and they carry out what we originally thought we were doing in the first place. So thank you.
Yeah, I should note that I put Harrison under extreme pressure those days. So this is actually a relatively small number given what I was trying to make him do in like a 48 to 72 hour period here on a Sunday night. Any questions about any of this?
Is there any action to be taken here?
We are going to introduce in a moment here not in a moment, but a little bit later, we're going to introduce this bill as
okay.
a committee
bill. LC 601.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, so the next piece is... for those of you who will continue to be on this committee, which we don't know what that looks like yet, or if this committee will even be the same committee in jurisdiction, something that I wanted to get folks started on understanding. We had a lot of discussion about it when it passed, but it's probably been forgotten already by most folks, unless you're in an area dealing with a UGB. And this is a new process that was created in 2013 for cities outside of Metro, another way for them to amend their UGBs, what we call kind of a fast-track process. So we wanted to get an update on how that's going and when we can expect to see our first I won't say guinea pig, but our first pilot, our pioneer city, go through this process. So, Carrie and Bob, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I will make sure that Bob Rindy introduces himself when he speaks, but he's sitting here to my right. He's our Senior Policy Analyst and the person who is leading the work group for us at the rulemaking work group for us at the state agency. So as Chair Clem indicated, the purpose of this is really just to provide this committee with a status update of where we are on legislation that was passed unanimously by the Oregon State Legislature in the 2013 session. The bill that I'm specifically referencing is House Bill 2254, and I believe in your electronic packet you received a one-pager as well as some additional background documents. Just to sort of round out that bill, there was a companion bill, House Bill 2254, from the 2013 legislative session, which provided a process for the state through the Portland State University's Population Research Center to produce routine and consistently updated population forecasts so that communities around the state would have a basis on which to do their long-range planning. This is a second step in that, which provides an alternative and new streamlined urban growth boundary evaluation and expansion process for growing cities. And so that's the first part that I always somehow forget to say until the end. It's an alternative process. So the old UGB process will still continue to exist. Cities will be able to elect which process they want to use. The purpose and design of the House Bill 2254 process, though, is to provide a more predictable, cost-efficient, and I would say actually time-efficient process for cities to evaluate whether or not they need to expand their urban growth boundaries, and then a process for actually deciding the expansion areas. I think to start us, that the problem that we were, you know, intending to solve was that for too many cities, there's too much time, too much expense, and too much litigation and lack of certainty about the long-range planning process. The goal here was to have the state engage in some of the empirical research that would help to provide the communities with the information that they needed in order to be able to do their long-range evaluations.
Representative Gilliam's joined us. We thought we would just get a picture of this. Yeah. Please, sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, I just thought something else more interesting was going on behind me.
We're not sure.
I will pay heed and look to your cue, Chair.
So that's the issue that we were trying to solve. I do want to say that there are a number of cities for whom the urban growth boundary amendment process does currently work. We've had some of them are smaller scale, some of them are larger scale, about 70 urban growth boundary expansions that have happened in the last 10 or 15 years. So depending upon how you count them as individual or clump them. So it's not a process that's entirely broken, but it's a process that clearly does not work for too many of our communities. So in 2013, we came together with a pretty large group of stakeholders and proposed the legislation, which gave the framework for our department and our commission to engage in rulemaking. Members of that group, that design group, continue to serve with us, and we're grateful for their service on our rulemaking advisory committee. Some of them were presenting to you earlier today. Some, I think, are still behind me, but we have John Chandler from the Oregon Home Builders Association, Sean Gillians representing the realtors, Mary Kyle from 1000 Friends of Oregon, Peggy Lynch from Oregon League of Women Voters, et cetera. So a pretty broad group, a number of private practice planners and attorneys as well serving on that rulemaking advisory committee, and a copy, I think, of the committee list was provided for you in your materials. We started doing our rulemaking with that work group last fall. We've had 7 meetings with the large work group. We've had more than that with smaller groups trying to work on various different issues surrounding the streamlined process. We will conclude our rulemaking, or the rules will be in effect on January 1st of 2016. So you gave us 2 years to do this complicated rulemaking, and we are making considerable headway. In order to have the hearings that we need to have, we anticipate that the draft rules will be actually in fairly solid form this summer so that we can do hearings around the state. To orient you really in terms of what the steps are, we have a general framework that was really laid out for the most part in the bill that we're sort of putting the meat to. That's the steps in the streamlined UGB process. There are 6 steps. They are fairly, I think, basic in their concept. One is to determine needs. So again, using that population forecast that will be provided by Portland State University, communities will have a framework that is basically developed by the department with a bunch of research that we're doing about historical development patterns to tell communities, well, here's how much your population is expected to grow by, and here's the way that you calculate, therefore, your needed land for housing and your needed land for employment. The next step for communities is to determine the supply. So what's the capacity that they have within their existing urban growth boundary? And again, we are will be providing a framework for communities to be able to evaluate how much land they have in those categories, which brings them to step 3, which is really ends up being a subtraction problem, something that even I might be able to do at the end of this, which is to say we know how much land we need, how much land we have, what's the actual expansion area. That top of the line, those first 3 steps, is really what our focus has been over the last 9 months. And we're just beginning to work on the next part, which is once you know that you need to expand, how do we identify what the appropriate study areas are and how communities should evaluate those lands for potential inclusion inside the urban growth boundary. A couple other highlights I would say of this new alternative process is that it changes it from a 20-year supply to a 14. Oh.
Sorry, Representative mm-hmm. Davis.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the population forecast, there was discussion about this when we passed it, is a comment-based procedure. It's not an appealable-based decision by the Population Center. When we get into these steps, step 1, 2, and 3 in particular, what is the, I assume it's the local jurisdiction that puts forth the proposal. What is the proposed appeal timelines like? What are we looking at there?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis. First, I want to confirm that you're correct. So on the House Bill 2253, the population forecasting, that's not a land use decision. It's not an appealable decision. So that sort of removes that from the equation. We've come up with a good way that everyone has agreed will produce solid results, such as forecasting, you know, to the limits of forecasting, and that we've removed that from being an appealable land use decision. Similarly, here in House Bill 2254, what will be the reason why we have spent so much time focused on looking first at historical development patterns, both on the employment side and on the housing side, and then are doing currently some research on what can we expect with market changes going forward, is that we will be developing ranges for communities. So they will have the discretion to choose within a reasonable range of what they predict their housing needs will be, what their employment lands will need to be. And if they're in that range, basically it is not an appealable decision. So if they land there, they're in a good place with respect to appeal. The actual timelines for appeals are not changed by the statute, but I would say it puts those communities on solid footing. And when I say it provides a predictable path for communities, that's precisely why it does, is because if communities elect a point within that range, then it is essentially appealable. Again, I go to, was there a math error? Is there some fundamental problem that you can clearly see? But it's not, that there is not the range of potential grounds for appeal. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
No, no, that's fine. The whole purpose of this is to engage in a conversation to let you know where we're going and the process. So I want to make sure we answer any questions. So as I say, right now we are sort of in these steps 4 and 5 phase of our rulemaking, and we do anticipate that we'll continue to work through the legislative session on this bill, and as I say, have the draft rules begin to be available for public hearings and additional comment this summer. There's been some interesting, one of the byproducts of this is the department up to this date really has not had the level of information that we have about development patterns, and it's been interesting, I think, for our committee and for our department to see some of those. One of them I would just highlight for you is the bill does call for us to look at regional differences, and we are doing that throughout the state. But it really appears, at least with respect to housing densities, and I don't think this is something that's altogether that surprising, that the size of the community or the city matters much more than the region of the state that it's in. And so we want to really make sure that as we're building these ranges, we're building them based on what we know empirically about past development patterns and what research indicates will be changes that we can expect in the future to assure that we're accommodating those future needs. With that, I don't know, Bob, if I'm sure there are parts that I left out. So Bob will tell you those, and then we'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the department. One thing that I think hasn't been touched on is a lot of the arguing that has gone on over urban growth boundaries. If you kind of step back and look at it, it's about land that is way out there in terms of its need. It's the edges of the urban growth boundaries. That's what traditionally has been the long sticking points in the arguing. And, you know, reasonably, that's land that's not needed for 18, 19, 20 years. And so it's, I think, a prominent feature of this new process, alternative process, is that it's a shorter time frame, the 14-year period. But the intent of that is to focus on land that's either it can be serviced or is serviced, and so that under this new alternative process, we're encouraging cities to really add land to urban growth boundaries that can be serviced reasonably, and to provide public facility planning to do that. And I think that's going to be a hard thing to achieve in terms of our rulemaking, in the sense that, of course, there's a component of servicing that comes down to local funding, and we're not going to have a whole lot of ability to change that. But the theory here being, we, at the end of the day, into this new process, we want to see service land in urban growth boundaries rather than land that's theoretically 20 years out could be someday used.
Thank you. You're touching on a question I have in my mind, I guess, is when you're defining the supply of land within your UGB, how does that, whether it's able to be developed or serviceable as such, how does that impact your equation for whether that's considered supply or not? And we have many unincorporated areas within urban growth boundaries that cannot be provided services because of the tax structure or the revenue stream available to develop that land. And so is that land that many would consider not serviceable, is that considered part of your capacity in your as far as your supply of land within your UGB?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, on that side, I will say candidly that we have not gotten down to that level of detail in our buildable lands inventory. My expectation is that lands that are already inside the UGB are within that considered part of the supply unless there are identified constraints that mean that land is essentially undevelopable. It becomes difficult in the area to give a sort of a blanket response when it has to do with public facilities provision, because the reasons for why that land isn't serviceable vary so much. You indicated one of them, which is significant, which are actual just funding issues with respect to ability to get the necessary financing for public facilities infrastructure. But there are other impediments in some areas as well that have to do with topography and distance issues. So we are trying, that the goal of this is to require that communities have a 14-year supply of serviceable land within their communities. We're working on that definition of what serviceable means, but it does mean for us that there is some sort of ability to not only physically get the infrastructure there, but have a way to finance those improvements.
Chair Clem, Rep. Holvey, another aspect of 2254, the legislation, was that it calls out when cities are exploring land for expanding, and I think this starts to drift into some of the land that's already in the boundary. The bill specifically allows, requires us in the rules to authorize cities to predict that the development capacity of areas that are already built will be lower. And indeed, I mean, that's probably the best we can do as a solution to the problem you're describing. Those lands are in the boundary already, and there will be lands like them that are in the potential expansion areas of UGBs. Rather than have cities just skip over those as undevelopable, the legislation authorizes that, or requires us to write rules that authorize local governments to put those in the boundary, but to predict their ultimate development capacity will be substantially reduced by some amount that we haven't come up with yet, but that we, based on the research that University of Oregon is giving us, I hope we're going to be able to get a pretty good handle on what that is, and that's the way that we'll deal with those areas.
Representative Davis. Thank you. So any cities lining up to be the guinea pig?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, I'm pleased that one city that has had some significant issues with their urban growth boundary, City of Woodburn, they're not on our committee, but they have been attending all of our meetings to watch the process. So not only are we getting input from those cities who are serving on the committee, but those who know that they want to expand their urban growth boundary and are looking at it as to understand the process and actually to give input to us along the way. So nobody has lined up. I don't expect them to. They don't yet know what it looks like. So I think they have the framework. I think we have communities that are interested in that framework, but none that have said me first. And we don't, the bill wasn't drafted, I guess I should just make clear, it wasn't drafted with the intention that there would be a pilot city. So this is intended to work for all growing communities. It does have a performance metric in it, which says that this needs to become the method essentially that is most used by communities. So not only do we have to create a new alternative path, but we actually have to create one that works and is used. And that will be the way in which we measure it. Last thing I'll say, and I think you have a follow-up question, is that there are a number of communities that are currently undergoing urban growth boundary work: City of Eugene, City of Springfield, City of Bend, and we are providing a crosswalk, if you will, between if communities, as we continue along, if they decide they want to get off that path and get onto the new path, we will be providing them a mechanism by which they can do that.
What's the threshold again? Is it 20,000 residents?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, there are two components. So it has a small city. This bill has a small cities provision and a larger city provision. So those cities under 10,000 in size will have even more simplified rules and processes to go through, and then larger communities over 10,000 have another set of standards. Typically, that the framework and the outcome is intended to be the same, but we are trying to create a more simplified process for those communities, which are really very small.
Outside of metro.
Outside of the metro area, yes. Thank you.
Chair Clem, Rep. Davis, on terms of cities that would be interested in using this, there's a phase in that is occurring because the way that Portland State Population Forecasting Center has rolled out their process to issue forecasts statewide is that there'd be three groups of forecasts. The first ones will be final this June, and that's going to be Southern Oregon and the Southern Coast, and then another group of forecasts in the Central and in Eastern Oregon that would be issued the following year, and then finally northern part of the state in the third year. And that means that the new method won't be available to a city until its Portland State forecast is final, and that means that the first cities to use this will be in the southern region of the state. Probably the second batch of them will be in Central and Eastern Oregon, and it won't be until the third year out with those forecasts that it's really available to the northern Willamette Valley and the northern coast.
Other questions? Okay.
Well, thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. We wanted just this brief opportunity to provide you the update. I imagine that there may well be legislation related to urban growth boundaries. I don't know of it right now, other than maybe the bill that you just heard with respect to a technical adjustments for urban and rural reserves in the metro area. But we wanted to make sure the committee had an update as to where we were, what geographic area of the state this covered, should any of those issues come before the committee in this next session.
Chair Claire, one more thing that's very important. You just heard about some Scrivener's errors in legislation. There was a minor Scrivener error in this bill. And so we will be bringing to you a little fix-it bill on that error. So you'll
give me a wide relating clause, and I'll see what else we can do with it.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, yeah, a little fix-it in land use.
Yeah, that's great. How exciting. Okay, thank you so much. All right, let's close our informational meeting and open a work session. Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Clem, I move that LC 1844, dated November 7th, 2014, be introduced as a committee bill.
Vice Chair McEwen moves that LC 1844, dated 11-7-2014, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? This is the technical adjustment bill.
Can we give it a name first?
Yeah.
Map adjustment. MACBT.
Technical.
TMACB.
TMACB.
Technical map adjustment.
Yeah. We'll call this the TMACB bill. Nothing about grand bargains. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. I will close the work session. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you all for serving in this committee. This will be our last chance to meet in its current form. We have at least one senator. I'm not going to say upgrading because that would disparage the House, but moving on.
If I'm not on the committee, can I come back?
Buying the committee lunch, I hear, for a celebration?
Apparently, I'm buying the committee lunch as a celebration. And one relatively short-term member who I butchered your name because I put a Y from your first name into...
There's Y is where there shouldn't be and Y is where...
Yeah, exactly. Should be Bowles, not Boyles. But thank you all for serving on the committee and look forward to working with you in whatever capacities we all end up in the future.
Thank you, as do I.
Thanks. You bet. And we should wish the Oregon Ducks luck.
Yay!
It's particularly painful for me to have to look at that, but as I was telling Representative Holvey, now I cannot root against the Ducks the way I used to because my good friend, starting at age probably 4 for him and 5 for me, is their head coach, and I don't really want to wish him ill and lose his job because he's one of the few people who probably is a multimillionaire already from my hometown. So we got,
it's a small world after all.
It is
one
a small
world. One of the good
world. Guys. Yeah. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the committee. Thanks.
All roads do come through Coosley at some point.
They do.
Yes, they do. All roads do come through Coosley at some point.
They do.